Stereo Theater presents The Scales of Justice.
All right. Oh. Yeah? No?
Rat.
Hey, you...
Watch where your child plays. Rat.
Rat. Stooley. The police consider an informer an essential part of law enforcement. The problem facing the police and the courts in the murder of informer Kenneth Landers in Waterloo, Ontario, on August the 9th, 1975, was reliability. That woman who was threatened was Nadine DeVoe, age 24, a single parent, an admitted shoplifter and drug addict who had come forward with information about the case. Miss DeVoe had been recently released from a heroin treatment program. Was she telling the truth? My name is Edward Greenspan, and the story you are about to hear is reconstructed from the trial transcripts in the Supreme Court of Ontario and the judgments of the Ontario Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court of Canada.
Of Justice, a series recreating real events in Canadian crime, with commentary by the Toronto lawyer, Edward L. Greenspan, QC. In this episode, you will hear Chappelle Jaffe as Nadine DeVoe and Michael J. Reynolds as Thomas French in the true story of A Truthful Witness, written by Robin Rowland and produced by George Jonas.
On the evening of August 9, 1975, Marie Fricke and a friend were playing cribbage on her patio at her farm home in St. Agatha on the outskirts of Waterloo, a third of a mile from a stand of woods on the Waterloo-Wilmot Road.
22?
And 31 for two.
No.
You want another game? It's 25 after 10.
Well, I guess we got time for one game before the National 11th. What was that?
Sounded like a shotgun. Someone must be clowning around. It came from the farm across the road.
A shotgun report is not unusual in rural Ontario. But at noon the next day, Sunday, August the 10th, Constable Paul Purchaluk of the Waterloo Regional Police glanced at something that made him stop.
Well, what was it caught your eye, Constable?
When I went by, I caught a glimpse of a vehicle down the laneway. It's a laneway just into a wooded area. There's nothing back there but bush. I observed a person in the box of a pickup truck, his legs dangling, and the rest of the body would be like leaning back into the pickup truck. Something seemed unnatural about the person laying there. His chest seemed to be pushed up towards the sky. I then happened to notice about 10 feet east of the truck, two shotgun shells on the ground. I didn't go towards them. I walked to the left, and I noticed that the person lying in the truck, his head was missing. It was gone as if exploded. The jaw wasn't there. You see, Staff, Willem? His left hand is deformed in a kind of a fist. And that second finger, which is crooked.
Yeah.
And his right hand is turned over. It doesn't seem natural.
It's Champ Landers.
Now, Staff Sergeant Willem, I want to ask you, first of all, how did you know Kenneth Landers, the deceased?
He would call me if a crime was going to occur, or he would call me and tell me a crime had occurred, and give me the names of the suspects.
Mm-hmm. And could you explain, please, to the jury whether you had some evidence about persons thinking he was an informer?
Yes, sir. On the street, he's known as a rat, and a rat is a person who informs on persons who are involved in crime.
Well, looking back, were you ever concerned in connection with how he handled himself as an informer?
Yes. He at times gave us certain information and wanted us to act on it. Our concern was that if we did, that people involved would know he told us.
Mm-hmm. And did that seem to concern him?
We warned him about this, but he didn't seem to know.
At the murder scene, the police found two sets of tire tracks, one from the truck, the second from a car to the right of and behind the truck. They were photographed. At 6:30 p.m., Staff Sergeant Wilhelm notified the dead man's wife, Marlene Landers. Mrs. Landers had just sat down to dinner with her three children and her friend and neighbor, Nadine DeVoe. Nadine said nothing as Staff Sergeant Wilhelm told Mrs. Landers the news of her husband's death. Police began to trace the last hours of Kenneth Landers, 40 years old, an alcoholic, who lived on a disability pension because he was paralyzed on one side. Landers had gone out drinking on the afternoon of August the 9th. The 17-year-old babysitter, Kevin Fleming, was in the house at 7 p.m. when Landers returned, drunk, and passed out on a couch. At 8:30, Fleming's girlfriend, Margaret Weiler, arrived. At about 9...
Yeah, hello?
Yeah, let me talk to Ken, will
you? He's sleeping. I'm the babysitter.
Well, it's important. Wake him up. I'm calling from London.
Just a minute. Hey, Margaret, hold on the phone a sec, will you? He says he's calling from London.
Okay.
Get Ken on the phone, will you?
Kevin's waking him up. Ken, get up. Come on.
Fuck off. Bring the phone over here. Here, Ken. The guy wants to talk to you long distance. Margaret, pull that cord a bit. I'll hold it to his ear.
Jesus Christ, will you fuck off? All right, goodbye.
Ken.
Okay, everything all right?
Yeah. Listen, do me a favor, will you? Get Ken to the corner of Glasgow and Groan in 15 minutes, or I'm not going to be able to pick him up, see? Now, he's going to be out $500 if he doesn't.
Okay.
Good.
Ken, you got to get up. I'm supposed to take you down to the corner.
Okay, did Mr. Landers get up?
He went back to sleep.
And what happened next?
Well, a guy came maybe 15 minutes or so later.
Mm-hmm.
The events of the next half hour were never clear. The babysitter said two men showed up at the house at different times. The first was never named, and the babysitters could never positively identify the man whom they described as big and dark-haired. The second man was a friend of the Landers named Earl Musselman. Musselman said he left the house when Landers refused to speak to him. Ken Landers left his home around 9:30 p.m. An hour later, he was dead. While Homicide was investigating the murder, the traffic division was looking into an accident that occurred sometime early Sunday morning. An abandoned 1970 Plymouth was found severely damaged and was towed to the police seizure yard. A while later, during a routine check of hospital emergency rooms, the investigating officer came upon a man named Thomas French.
How'd you hurt yourself?
Fell down the stairs at home. I wasn't in no car accident.
The trouble with that statement, aside from the fact that it was untrue, was that the police had not mentioned to Thomas French that they were investigating an accident. They took a second look at the car, particularly its tires. The Plymouth was a courtesy car owned by a mechanic. It had been loaned to a man named Bill Kiso, who showed up at the seizure yard.
Look, I need my suitcase.
No, you can't get your stuff out of the trunk. The car's evidence in an investigation. Now, you said you weren't driving.
I lent the car to Tom French.
Why?
We were going to pick up some beer for today, like that on Sunday, and I think Tom said he'd go get it. I said, well, look, here's the keys. You take my car.
So, Staff, I inked the tire from the Plymouth onto this piece of cardboard. It's got seven linear treasures, similar to the photographs, that sort of zigzag S-shape.
So, we should ask French a question or two?
Yeah, but I called the manufacturer. He said it's common. In fact, he sells thousands of them a year.
Yes, there were thousands of such tires in southwestern Ontario. This made the car a very weak link indeed between Tom French and the Landers case, even though it did emerge that French and Landers had known each other. Police would later estimate they interviewed between 50 and 60 people in connection with the murder. One of them was Nadine DeVoe.
No, I don't know nothing.
What about Tom French?
Oh, sure, yeah, he was at the City Hotel.
What time?
I don't know.
Say between 9 o'clock and 11?
Yeah, Tommy was there.
It was not until a month later, on September the 18th, after Tom French was released from hospital, that the police questioned him. French, a man in his 30s, had a minor criminal record. He was unemployed and had lived on a disability pension since breaking both his knees in an accident. Staff Sergeant Wilhelm met with French and his lawyer at the time at the detective office. Wilhelm did something he had never done before. He taped the session, hiding the recorder in a briefcase on the interview table. He did not tell French or his lawyer that they were being taped.
Yeah, I went over to Landers. I wanted to talk to him about parts from his VW.
You have a shotgun?
Yeah, I've got an old gun at the park.
You have any other guns?
No. Look, I don't know nothing about who killed Chamber.
The police continued their investigation and their search for the shotgun with no results. On October the 21st, the police held a press conference.
We have one more release this morning. The police commission has authorized a reward of $2,000 for the arrest and conviction of the slayer of Kenneth Landers. You'll remember that the body was found in a pickup truck in a wooded area about 5 miles northwest of Waterloo. Landers was killed by two close-range blasts to the head from a 12-gauge shotgun.
It is common police procedure to withhold certain details of a case from the media, and up until now, police had followed that procedure. The initial release had not mentioned that Landers had been shot in the head. The police hoped the reward would bring forward someone with information, but now they had also released to the public new details of the murder, and the defense would point out that after October the 21st, everyone knew what happened to Ken Landers.
Hello?
Rat!
In the weeks since she had been interviewed by the police, Nadine DeVoe had been drinking heavily. On her own evidence, she received three threatening phone calls in October. At this point, she had done nothing to warrant the calls, and defense counsel at trial would raise questions about that. One day in December, according to Nadine, she checked her mail.
What the fuck?
Nadine said she received two shotgun shells in the mail that day and a threatening call in January. In February, she was charged with impaired driving. In March came the threatening call we heard at the beginning of this episode.
Hey, you.
Watch where your child plays, rat.
A few days later, on April the 2nd, Nadine DeVoe was again charged with impaired driving and failing to take a breathalyzer test. On the morning of April the 8th, Nadine walked into the Waterloo detective office.
Hey, is Stu Wilhelm around? I want to talk to him.
Hi, Nadine. Can I tell the staff what it's about?
Sure. You know who killed Gimp Landers? Tommy French. And Bob Urbanek.
What?
Yes. They told me all about it.
A curious chain of events. According to Nadine, she was receiving threats and accusations of being an informer before she had done anything. Nadine asked for protection for herself and her 2-year-old daughter. As a result of what she told police, Thomas French and Robert Urbanek, who lived at the French farm, were charged on April the 9th, 1976, with the non-capital murder of Kenneth Landers. The case went to trial on September 21st, 1976. The witnesses would agree on how the events of that Saturday began when Marlene Landers and Nadine DeVoe arrived at the Coronet Hotel sometime after 3 p.m. About 3/4 of an hour later, Tom French arrived at the Coronet Hotel. There were three versions of the events over the next few hours. Most important to the prosecution was Nadine DeVoe's story. She claimed she overheard the following conversation between Tom French and Marlene Landers.
Chamber's a rat, you know.
Oh, I can't really believe that.
You told the cops your father.
Well, what is your proof? How do you know?
My lawyer told me. You still got that insurance policy on the gun?
Yeah, I do.
So if he dies, you get $10,000? And if it's an accident, anyway, well, you get $20,000 if it's an accident. How much would it be worth to you if Ken was to be killed or died somehow?
Well, if I'm getting $20,000, $6,000, you know, would be fair.
Well, all you've got to do is give the word.
Well, sure.
Marlene Landers had a different story to tell.
Thank you. We'll be right back.
You know, Ken's been drinking an awful lot lately. He's gotten in an accident, eh? One of these days he's going to meet his Waterloo. Can't walk, let alone drive a truck. One of these days he's gonna wrap it around a tree.
Well, at least you can collect the insurance money.
Yeah. It'll be double indemnity if it was accidental.
It's double indemnity if you wrap it around a tree, eh?
Yeah. Ken's yappy when he's drinking. He's real mousy. He's bitter, you know. Eh? He thinks people look down on him. He's afraid to go any place unless he has a few drinks in him for courage. He hasn't worked since he hurt his neck. He's got some wires in his neck.
He's a rat, you know.
All right, I don't know. I've heard that too, but I've no proof. So I don't know anything about that. He's got time on his hands. He's just yappy. He knows just about everything that goes on in this town. Tommy, your wife Gloria, she's yappy when she's drinking.
Tom French had a different version of the conversation.
Marlene, you're on mother's allowance, right?
Yeah.
You want insurance for your kids?
Huh?
I got this friend, see? He sells life insurance. He found this clause where if you're on mother's allowance or welfare, eh, you can have your kids insured and mother's allowance pay for it. Won't cost you nothing. Hey, so here. Let me give you the guy's card. I get a kickback from the guy if you get the insurance.
Okay.
He said Ken needs money.
Yeah, he's strapped. I gave him some so he could go out to Keith's place.
The old VW's still in the backyard?
Yeah.
Maybe I'll give him $10 for it. You know, Ken's a stool pigeon.
I don't believe it.
He told me himself. He didn't say much, but he told me he put the finger in your father for impaired driving. To get him out of your house. He ain't capable of grabbing him and throwing him out of the house, so he called the cops on him.
I don't know. I don't have any proof of it.
Well, he's pretty yappy, eh?
Yeah, but so's your wife Gloria when she's had a few.
Three critically different versions. Nadine's story would, if believed, be evidence of premeditated murder. The other two accounts were completely innocuous. One thing everyone did agree on was that at 6 o'clock, Ken Landers showed up at the Coronet. He had one drink and then left. He was home by 7, where he passed out in front of the babysitter. First, though, he apparently made a phone call.
Marlene,
that call was your old man.
He said he wants you home.
Then
he hung up on me. Ready to go? I told him he already left, so we can go whenever we want.
I'm ready. Let's go.
As Marlene and Nadine went to the City Hotel, Tom French borrowed Kiso's Plymouth, bought a case of beer, then had two drinks at the Station Hotel before driving to the Landers' house.
Hey, Jasper! You
want
to sell your
Volkswagen? Huh? What?
Tommy?
Yeah. Yeah, for half a yard.
$50. You're nuts, you know that? It's not worth 15. Look, next time you feel like a couple of two-fours, give me a call.
Marlene Landers would testify that Tom French arrived at the City Hotel sometime after 9, just before she and Nadine went out again, this time to a Kmart where Nadine stole slacks, a blouse, and underwear. Neither Marlene nor Nadine remembered seeing French at the City Hotel when they returned from the Kmart just after 10. Ken Landers, of course, was alive and at home until at least 9:30 when he left his house. So Tom French's whereabouts at this time were highly important. In court, French told the following story to his lawyer, Clayton Ruby.
Where did you go after you left Mr. Landers? After this conversation about buying his Volkswagen?
City Hotel.
Are you able to tell me what time you would have arrived there?
I know it was before 10 o'clock.
And did you see anybody when you came into the hotel?
Marlene, Nadine, Bill Buck and I came in right around the same time, I think.
Do you remember how long you were in the City Hotel?
We sat there for quite a while. Everybody's feeling pretty good, drinking heavily, I guess. I remember someone juggling oranges. Then Erickson and Holbrook were two guards at the jail next door. They came in. I knew them. They sat at another table, and I went over and sat with them. And I don't know how long later the place started flooding.
Four witnesses would testify for the defense that they saw Tom French at the City Hotel. Bill Buck said he was with French there from 9:30 until midnight. So did Brian Holzhauer. If any of these people were believed, or if the jury thought they might be telling the truth, they would provide a good alibi for Tom French. The two jail guards testified they arrived at the City Hotel around 11:45. The beverage room was flooded just after midnight. Nadine DeVoe's story of the night of August the 9th was not just a matter of that insurance money conversation. She tied both defendants directly to the murder. It began when Nadine said she saw Robert Urbanek, a man who shared his living quarters with Tom French.
At approximately 11 o'clock, I saw Urbanek standing at the bar, and he summoned me to come over.
Hey, Nadine!
You're moving your fingers towards you.
Hey, Tommy wants to talk to you. He's out in the car.
Did you go out the back door?
Yes, I did. Hiya, Tommy.
Well, the gimp is dead. Yeah. You know, he said, go ahead and pull the trigger if you got the nerve. I shot him. He died like a dog.
Are you sure that's what happened?
Yes.
Well, it's better off that the gimp is dead. Tommy, I gotta go to the John. Hotel and I was crying in the washroom because I was upset. Like, I was in the washroom, that must have been about 15 minutes, and when I came out, he still hadn't come in, and when I sat at the table, he came in.
Hey, kid.
Oh. Hi, Tom.
Hey, I want a drink.
And that was Nadine's story. As a result of it, Tom French was charged with murder. But what about Robert Urbanek? Well, it seems Nadine DeVoe had some other information for the police. She told them she had two other conversations with Urbanek at the Coronet Hotel. The first was about 2 weeks after the murder. Nadine said she was there with her boyfriend, Donnie Morrison, and Urbanek.
Jeff died like a dog. You know, I shot him.
Holy.
Yeah, his head didn't come off, so I shot him.
Urbanek, keep your mouth shut.
The second incident, she said, took place a few days later. Nadine said she overheard Urbanek say something else.
There's blood everywhere. I mean, Chambers' blood was splattered all over the back of the truck.
Nadine DeVoe had one more incident to relate. This one took place in a room over a barbershop about 3 weeks after the murder. Several people were present, but Nadine would testify that at one point the three of them, Nadine, Tom French, and Robert Urbanek, were alone.
I wonder how Duke the Pakistan man is going to look once his hair is dyed blonde.
Well, wait and see.
Open another bottle.
Okay. Give me your glass.
You know, Tommy, Marlene wasn't serious about it. She's got no idea she's going to have to pay you money or anything like that.
She'd bloody better remember it.
The other evidence against Tom French was, as the trial judge would later comment, wholly circumstantial and very weak. Tires on the Plymouth he was driving matched those at the scene, but so did thousands of similar tires in the Waterloo region. French had admitted going to the Landers' house to try to buy the Volkswagen. And that, essentially, was the case against French and Urbanek. It rested almost completely on the evidence of Nadine DeVoe that she had overheard French plot with Marlene Landers to kill her husband for insurance money. And then later, she had heard French and Urbanek separately confess the killing to her. But French also had witnesses testifying he was in the City Hotel from 9:30 on. In order to convict, the jury was going to have to believe Nadine DeVoe beyond a reasonable doubt. Tom French's lawyer set about raising that doubt in his cross-examination of Nadine, who those involved would later say was a stunning young woman.
It looks to me like you're wearing a new outfit today. How old would it be?
How old? About 2 years old, sir.
Did you buy it or steal it?
I stole it, sir.
You're standing in this witness box under oath in clothes that you stole?
Yes, sir.
How often do you steal?
Frequently.
In fact, you steal every other day.
I do not steal every other day. I haven't stolen anything in over a year.
But about the time of this particular murder, you were stealing every other day.
Yes, sir, I was.
And doing so for years?
3 years, sir.
Occasionally, you would take a day off from stealing?
Sir, when I needed something, I did steal it, yes.
About the period of August 9th, or prior to that period, did you use any drugs?
Yes, sir.
What kind of drugs?
Tranquilizers.
Any other kind?
Yes, when I was younger. When I was in Niagara Falls, and that would be when I was just turning 16 until I was 18.
Not after that?
No, sir.
And how old are you today?
24.
And the drugs that you used were on a doctor's prescription?
Yes, sir. They were prescription.
Who prescribed heroin for you?
Nobody prescribed that for me. You told me to admit when I was 16 and when I was in Niagara Falls. You did not say... You said the tranquilizers. I believe I have answered you correctly.
You haven't used heroin since you were 16?
No, sir. I used that for a number of years, right up till I was 18, sir.
After 18, you never used heroin?
No, sir.
Do you recall attending Kitchener-Waterloo Hospital on February 6, 1975... being admitted on a stretcher, provisional diagnosis, drug addiction?
I recall it. I do remember, yes, sir.
You recall telling the doctor you had been a heroin user for 6 to 7 years, having started out on marijuana, then going on to speed, and finishing by intermittent use of heroin. You recall telling him you had been mainlining heroin for the past 6 months, and your habit was costing you wholesale $120 a day?
No, sir, I do not.
Are those facts true?
Some of them are true, sir. Some of them are not, also.
Well, which are true and which are not?
All right, using heroin and mainlining for 7 years are not true.
You had at the time, February 6, 1975, been mainlining heroin for the past 6 months?
No, sir.
How long?
3 months.
The doctor was in error when he said six.
Very possibly he isn't. I was afraid of a comedown, and I wanted him to give me something that would help me with withdrawal. I wanted him to think I was addicted, sir, so I could have an easier comedown.
This goes on. She has been dealing to get money for her addiction.
That isn't correct. My boyfriend was. I received the capsules from him. I told the doctor things I thought would be necessary. If I put it with me, it would be the same, so why get my boyfriend into trouble?
Isn't that what you are doing today, telling us things you think are necessary?
No. I'm telling the truth.
How did you manage to forget the heroin used?
I just forgot about it completely, sir. I really, truly did.
You said what a horrible experience coming down from heroin is.
It wasn't so bad last time I came down.
You're not just making up answers now, too.
No, sir.
Are you lying to this jury or just mistaken?
No, sir, I'm not lying to this jury, and I'm not lying to you.
From time to time, you have a problem with excessive drinking.
Lately? Yes, I have.
Have you ever been suicidal?
Yes. sir. I have.
Well, would you agree, looking back on what you told us, that you are a person with severe psychiatric problems?
No, sir. I am extremely frightened. I've been under a lot of stress and I have a lot of fear. Now, if that means to say that I am lying on the stand after I am under oath, no, sir, I believe I am a credible witness and I have no psychiatric problems. I'm sure of that. Yes, I am frightened and I imagine many people would be.
With respect to Robert Urbanek, there was nothing to implicate him but Nadine's story. His lawyer, Sidney Linden, cross-examined her.
And Mr. Urbanek signaled you out?
Yes, sir.
Just you. And he told you Tommy French wanted to talk to you.
Yes, sir.
Perhaps you could explain why Tommy French would signal you out.
I really don't know, sir.
Wouldn't it make more sense for him to call Marlene Landers out?
Very possibly he could have.
Mm-hmm. If he was conspiring with her, you'd think the dirty deed done, he'd want to tell her about it.
But also, why not inform me and then I wouldn't tell anybody?
Well, is that what he said to you?
No, he didn't say that, sir. That's what I thought. You asked me why, and that's what I thought.
It would make more sense, perhaps, if he had said to you, "No, Nadine, I want to tell you something in secret. I don't want you to ever tell anybody." But he didn't say that.
No, sir, he didn't.
As Linden continued to question Nadine, it was soon apparent she was confused about the dates when she received threats and her reasons for going to the police.
Why did you wait from December, when you received the shells in the mail, until April, during which time you received no threats?
The threat I got last time that really frightened me was, "Watch where your child plays." It was 3 a.m, and I wanted to leave town, so I had to go to the police.
Well, let's assume for a moment that what you told us about the night of August 9th is the truth, that Tommy French took you into his confidence. Okay, can you explain why a month or so later he or anybody else would threaten you?
No, sir.
Having made that point, Linden moved on to make an even more important one on behalf of his client.
Now, you testified earlier today with respect to a day when a Pakistani gentleman had his hair dyed, and you said, "Also upstairs in the apartment, Robert Urbanek was there." But it was Tom French who spoke to you and said this. She bloody well better remember it.
Yes.
And Urbanek was there?
Urbanek was there. May I clarify something?
Yes.
I didn't mean to say he was upstairs when Tommy said what he said.
Your answer now is that Mr. Urbanek wasn't there.
He was present through the day when we were at Adam Hansen's place and when people went downstairs to dye the Pakistani's hair blonde. Urbanek wasn't present when Tommy was talking to me.
He was simply in the building, not in the room.
Yes, that's what I meant.
And so, Nadine calmly reversed her ground on this issue. The Crown case ended. It was now the turn of the defense. Tom French was called to testify in his own behalf.
Miss DeVoe has described a meeting with you in a car and in the parking lot at the City Hotel. Did that meeting occur?
No, sir. No way.
Did you ever tell her you had killed Mr. Landers?
No, sir. Never.
What was your relationship with Ken Landers?
I would call him a friend, but not really a close friend.
Did he ever hurt you in any way?
No, sir. I don't think Chapper would do anything to me. I'd never do anything to him.
Did he ever do anything for you?
He helped me how to get disability, which is an income for my family no matter what I do.
You testified he told you he was a police informer.
Yeah, but not what you'd call a rat. And the way Champer told me it wasn't that way. It was like members of his family, if they annoyed him, like his wife, his in-laws, if they annoyed him. He'd just get on the blower and phone the police and say, "So-and-so just left my place driving such and such a car and he's drunk." He done it. His father-in-law, he told him.
Did you kill Kenneth Landers?
No, sir.
The Crown Attorney, William Morrison, cross-examined.
Don't you agree that the description Miss DeVoe says she heard, "Go ahead and pull the trigger if you've got the nerve," doesn't that seem to fit Kenneth Landers?
I don't know. I never had a gun pointed at my head.
He was mouthy and very aggressive?
Yeah. I have no idea. I don't know.
Well, doesn't it appear he was just sitting on the back of the tailgate?
I guess so. I don't know.
Was a rather unusual position if he was with a stranger, wouldn't you think?
I have no idea, sir. How do you sit with a stranger?
Well, you haven't told us whether or not you were ever familiar with the barbershop known as Adam and...
Gene. Adam and Gene.
Do you recall the day you were down there, according to Mr. DeVoe, when this...
I remember the day. In fact, he got his hair dyed.
Or bleached, she told us that.
No, it wasn't bleached either. It was dyed red.
So she was correct in what she told us. There was a day a Packy chap got his hair dyed red.
Sure.
And apparently some drinking went on through the day upstairs?
Yeah, upstairs in the barbershop.
Mm-hmm. And do you recall speaking to her upstairs, first of all?
First of all, I'd never been in a room alone with her.
It didn't happen?
No, she mightn't even have been there. I'm not positive she was there the day Duker got his hair dyed red or not. There were probably 10 people. We drank about 3 or 4 40-ounces.
Now, Nadine indicated that she was telling you that Marlene didn't remember any business about paying any insurance money and that she didn't take it serious. And then she reported that your response was, well, she bloody better remember. Is that a fair way of summarizing her evidence?
Is that a... It wasn't said. That's what she said.
Did you say anything like that to her?
No, sir. Nothing like that at all.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, my lord. As far as you know, then, Nadine DeVoe had nothing against you.
No, that's not true.
Well, tell us what she had against you that would make her single you out.
She used to live with a friend of mine, and I talked him into leaving her.
Any other reason you think prompted her to single you up?
How about $5,000 worth? The reward?
Do you really think she's going to incur the risk of coming into this courtroom?
You bet.
Well, prior to the time she came forward to the police, was Nadine quite a popular person in the group?
No.
Well, would you say that she
popular
was...
Popular in what way? Standing up or laying down?
She's made no bones about some of the things she's done. When I said popular, I didn't mean it in that way. I mean easy to talk to, easy to meet.
One drink and she got fanged.
Well, I suggest that she was looked upon as a rather trusted, quotes around it, individual.
Unquote, she wasn't. When she lived with one fellow, that's why he left her, because she was a klepto, too.
I know, she told me.
I mean, she steals off her friends, too, and not just off strangers.
I think she's indicated all that.
Well, that isn't a trusted person. And I might have made my money dishonestly, but I never stole off my friend.
At this stage, it was hard to judge how the jury would view Tom French's evidence. The next witness for the defense was Don Morrison, who had become Nadine's lover soon after the murder. Morrison told the court of a fight Nadine had had with Gloria French. Back at the apartment he shared with Nadine, he said the following scene took place.
I'll get even with that fat bitch.
What are you talking about? Besides her, she'll eat you.
Well, I'll put her old man in jail for life.
What are you talking about? You know something about that murder?
No, but I'll make something up.
And you have had personal experience with her truthfulness. Would you believe her under oath?
Not really, no.
There were questions from Sidney Linden about the scene Nadine had said took place in the Coronet Hotel 2 weeks after the murder.
Can you recall Mr. Urbanek saying anything about the killing of Ken Landon?
No.
And about you having to quiet him down, asking him to cool it, not to talk about killing Ken Landon?
No.
So Morrison directly refuted Nadine on this point. He also had raised a possible reason for her to be lying about Tom French, and had given his opinion on her truthfulness. On this issue of truthfulness, French's lawyer next tried something unusual. He had arranged for Dr. Andrew Malcolm, a highly respected psychiatrist, to sit in court and watch Nadine during her evidence. Now he wanted to call the doctor to give his views based solely on his courtroom observations. This unusual tactic had been forced on the defense because the Crown had refused to allow Dr. Malcolm to examine Nadine prior to trial. The Crown now raised objections. So first, Dr. Malcolm described his conclusions for Mr. Justice Griffiths in the absence of the jury, so the judge could rule on whether his evidence should be admitted.
Now, you have observed character disorders in persons in your practice.
Yes, most certainly I have.
Can you give me an idea of how many?
Probably a couple of hundred people over a long period of time.
Can you tell me about the nature of a person with a character disorder?
Such a person is at least of average intelligence, sometimes higher, speaks rather glibly, appears to be rather sincere and convincing. He'll have a tendency to break rules and then have very little remorse about it. That person doesn't seem to care, doesn't seem to learn, and yet is extremely defensive about anything that's happened and will defend that position until incontrovertible evidence is presented to him.
So they don't tell the truth?
Such people will easily fabricate a lie.
This evidence of Dr. Malcolm, tendered in the absence of the jury, set up one of the most fascinating issues of the French case. On the one hand, trial by psychiatrist, or indeed by any other kind of expert, is not a pleasant prospect. We cannot allow a situation where every witness in a trial is subject to scrutiny during their evidence by a battery of psychiatrists for both sides, who would then, in their turn, give evidence as to whether they thought the witness was likely to be telling the truth. This would involve a complete usurping of the function of the jury, which is to weigh the evidence themselves and decide which witnesses they believe. At the same time, while recognizing all of this, any defense counsel would have to feel an instinctive sympathy for Clayton Ruby in the situation he faced. The whole case against his client rested on the credibility of Nadine DeVoe. Calling a psychiatrist to testify as to a character disorder he observed in her, one that involved a propensity to lie, must have seemed a vitally important aspect of his defense of Thomas French. There are precedents in our law, sound ones in my view, that hold that the rules of evidence should not be applied as strictly against an accused person as against the state. This might have been a cornerstone of the defense argument for the admissibility of this evidence. But it was somewhat forestalled by a question the trial judge asked of the witness and a very critical answer from Dr. Malcolm.
One moment, Mr. Ruby. I have a question for Dr. Malcolm.
Yes, my lord.
The character disorder you speak of, Doctor, wouldn't it be just as evident to lay people, having heard her evidence and having assessed it, as to a psychiatrist?
It's just a matter of degree, my lord. I recognize that these things I observe may also be observed by lay people. But I have some clinical experience, and I've read the literature on the subject, so I think it's possible that I might be able to make more sense out of the constellation of traits that I saw than might a lay person. That's all. And it's only a matter of degree.
Only a matter of degree. We will never know what might have happened had Dr. Malcolm said that a layperson would not be able to observe the character disorder he saw. We should also be aware that had Dr. Malcolm not been forbidden by the Crown to examine Nadine prior to trial, his expertise may have assisted him to see things in her character that a layperson could not have discerned. But as matters stood, Mr. Justice Griffiths ruled as follows.
In my view, the jury is eminently qualified to judge the character and credibility of Nadine DeVoe on the basis of her examination. I am persuaded there is a real risk that the jury would be unduly influenced by the qualifications of the doctor in concluding that they must find Nadine DeVoe is unworthy of belief. I therefore rule that evidence of the doctor will not be accepted.
So it was left for the defense lawyers and the Crown to sum up. French's lawyer went first.
She is not close friends with Tom French. Why on earth would Tom French sit down and talk in front of her? It is crazy. Does Tom French strike you as a congenital idiot? Who does this alleged killer report back to? The woman who was paying him? No. He goes to Nadine DeVoe. It is all very theatrical. Ask yourself, why is she always alone?
Sidney Linden for Robert Urban.
When the Crown closed its case and said no more evidence, I thought of the lyrics to the tune that Peggy Lee sings. Is that all there is? Is that the case?
The Crown had a few points to make. A defense of Nadine DeVoe.
Do you think a girl who has a criminal record, who has been a drug addict, been in a straitjacket, is going to do something like this to get off an impaired charge? No, she wouldn't. The best example I can give you of the risk that she undertook going to the police and coming in here and being an informer to you is the very thing that happened to Champ Landers. She's scared. Good reason. She told you standing in the Supreme Court of Ontario, yes, I am wearing a stolen dress. Okay, she didn't come in here as a minister of justice. She didn't set herself up in front of you with a goody-goody. No way. She came in here, and I suggest she bared her soul to you. Every sin, every conviction, every bad act, even wearing a stolen dress. Now, maybe she hasn't lived a good life. But when you bring in a witness who knows things, you don't go around selecting the outstanding citizen of the year. Just because she was such and such, don't say, we can't believe her as a truthful witness.
And then it was time for Mr. Justice Griffiths to charge the jury.
I would direct you in strong terms that you scrutinize her evidence most carefully. But because she is a person with a criminal record and of ill repute, then you should be even more careful in weighing her evidence, which is uncorroborated as far as statements to her are concerned. Members of the jury, even people with criminal records and people who are on drugs and people who have a bad reputation are capable of telling the truth. If you assess this girl on the basis of what you saw of her as a truthful witness, if you are satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt that what she says is true, then you must act upon it. It is your duty to act. And in my view, you have no alternative to find, if you believe her beyond a reasonable doubt, that French is guilty of killing Landers. With respect to Robert Urbanek, has the Crown satisfied you of the guilt of the accused beyond a reasonable doubt? It is your duty to give the benefit of the doubt, if there is one.
And so it was up to the jury to decide if Nadine DeVoe was a truthful witness. If they believed her beyond a reasonable doubt.
Have you agreed upon your verdict?
Yes, sir, we have.
Do you find Thomas French guilty or not guilty?
Guilty, sir.
Do you find Robert Urbanek guilty or not guilty?
Not guilty.
The jury had chosen to believe Nadine's evidence about Tom French, but it acquitted Robert Urbanek. Thomas French appealed to the Ontario Court of Appeal, in part relying on the argument that Dr. Malcolm's evidence should have gone to the jury. Mr. Justice McKinnon admonished the Crown in his judgment for not permitting Dr. Malcolm access to Nadine, but this had no ultimate impact on the decision he wrote for the court.
The jury in this case had to be given a warning, but once the warning had been given, it was not in need of expert assistance in weighing such evidence. A jury must be free to carry out its vital and essential function as a trier of fact. Trial by psychiatrist is not an attractive prospect. The appeal must be dismissed.
French's lawyer appealed to the Supreme Court of Canada on the same grounds. Then,
I was doing my research, and I had another look at the charge by Mr. Justice Griffiths.
Why was she signaled out to become privy to this very serious and very dangerous conversation? Why would she be permitted to overhear it, as suggested by one of the counsel? Why would they let her in on it? Well, the Crown suggests that maybe it was a matter of pride for the accused to tell her.
A matter of pride. In the appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada, French's lawyer raised the possibility that Thomas French had not been truthful when he was drunk and told Nadine he had killed Ken Landers. He might have been lying in drunken boastfulness. Nadine might have been telling the truth about the confession. But the judge, it was argued, should have told the jury they also had to be satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt that the confession was true. The Honorable Mr. Justice Betts wrote the opinion of the court.
The whole tenor of the defense was that Nadine DeVoe was the liar, not the accused. The record discloses no evidence tending to show the appellant lied if he made incriminating statements. But even if the trial judge did err, I am nevertheless satisfied when the charge is read as a whole that this is a case in which no substantial wrong or miscarriage of justice resulted. The learned trial judge repeatedly instructed the jury to consider all the evidence. I would dismiss the appeal.
There was nowhere else to appeal. The conviction was upheld. Aside from the challenging question of the psychiatric evidence, the French case is fascinating and important for another reason as well. On the face of it, Nadine DeVoe would seem the worst possible person to carry the full weight of the Crown's case in a murder trial. She had a criminal record, was an admitted drug abuser, testified in a stolen dress. She even had a former lover come to court and give evidence of a fight she had had with Tom French's wife and her threats to get French put away. Not only that, the jury didn't even believe her on the whole of her evidence. They acquitted Robert Urbanek. One might be tempted to label Tom French's conviction as shocking or even perverse, except for one thing. A jury of 12 people heard Nadine DeVoe, and despite all of the things we know and they knew, those 12 people were the ones who heard her, and they decided that, on the question of Tom French's murder of Champ Landers, Nadine DeVoe was a truthful witness. If nothing else, the French case must make us painfully aware of how easy it can be to be convicted of a criminal offense, even murder. It must make us constantly vigilant to preserve those safeguards our system has to protect someone accused of a crime. However rarefied or abstract our law might sometimes seem, we must remember that it comes back, in the end, to people and to human lives.
Well, the gift is dead. Yeah. You know, he said go ahead and pull the trigger if you got the nerve. I shot him. He died like a dog.
Well, better off if the gift is dead.
You said the man would be better off if he were dead. Why better?
Sir, I was over at his place many times when he suffered with his legs and his arm, and he was an alcoholic, and how sick he used to get and break out in sores, and they would never heal, and he was just really a sad man, that's all. A very, very sad man.
You have heard the true story of A Truthful Witness, an episode in our series, The Scales of Justice, recreating real events in Canadian crime. The script was by Robin Rowland, and the commentary by the Toronto lawyer, Edward L. Greenspan, QC. In the cast, you have heard Chappelle Jaffe as Nadine DeVoe, and Michael J. Reynolds as Thomas French. The Crown Attorney was played by Harvey Atkin, and the defense lawyers were David Calderisi and Paul Soles. The role of Marlene Landers was played by Jane Eastwood. You have also heard Eva Almas, Maya Ardahl, Grant Buchanan, John Evans, David Ferry, James Morris, Frank Perry, Angela Rizakos, Wayne Robson, John Scott, Chuck Shabata, John Stalker, Michael Tate, and Murray Westgate. Forensic psychiatrist Dr. Andrew Malcolm, the expert witness for the defense, recreated his actual involvement in the trial. Technical operations were by Brian Pate, and sound effects by Stephanie McKenna. The production assistant was Nancy McElveen. The music consultant, Stephanie McKenna. And the casting director, Ann Weldon Tate, with the assistance of Catherine Kester. The associate producer is Guy Gabriel Kay. The Scales of Justice is produced in Toronto by George Jonas. This is Fred Napoli speaking. Next week, listen to Michael and Susan Hogan in The House on the Hill, a dramatization of the murder of Edmonton golf pro Frank Wiley on The Scales of Justice.